so great for my family that
we're about to begin.
Losing her back to Baker. All right.
House Committee on Revenue for May 10th, 2017 will come to order. Colleagues, we have quite a bit of business to do today, but I noticed that the good senator from the coast is here to be heard on Senate Bill 311. So we'll begin with the public hearing on Senate Bill 311. Who's presenting that? Kyle is. Kyle will give us a short summary, and then we'll hear from Senator Roblin. There's some people to be heard.
Take it back.
Yeah, they're still signing up right now. Swell the sheet in a second. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 311. There's a bit of ink on this bill, so I'll try to hit just the high points on it. But it's creating a permissive property tax exemption for a city or county, and it allows the city or county to adopt an ordinance or a resolution providing exemption or either a full exemption or a partial exemption from ad valorem property taxes to eligible property that will be seismically retrofitted. So the property tax exemption, it's up to a 15-year property tax exemption. Like I said, it is a full or partial. And the property that would be exempt in this case are the improvements to the property, and it's only for properties that are built prior to January 1st, 93, and are commercial, industrial, or multifamily. So it does exclude state appraised industrial property and centrally assessed properties. And the exemption amount, again, will be determined by the city or the county in the ordinance or resolution, whether they'll do a full or a partial. But it's 15 years, and it ends at the end of the 15-year period or when the amount of the exemption, so the foregone property taxes, are equal to the amount of the eligible costs of retrofitting the property. The measure does provide a fair amount of ability of the city or the county to further restrict or place further restrictions on the property tax exemption program, how they put it in place, including restricting it on the number or the type of eligible properties, the overall cap on the amount of the property tax exemption, and then also allows the city or county to impose any other non-conflicting requirements. Lastly, I would touch on that there is a requirement that 75% of the taxing districts, based upon their tax that they do impose, have to go along with the city or county ordinance and resolution for it to take effect. And there is a sunset for January 2nd, 2028. However, for properties that are already qualifying for the exemption, they would have that full up to 15-year period following that 2028 sunset.
Well, the 28 sunset would be basically on starting the process.
Exactly, Mr. Chair, yes.
Right. Thank you. Welcome, Senator.
Thank you, Chair Barnhart, and the rest of the committee. For the record, I am Arne Roblin, State Senator from District 5, part of the epicenter if we have a Cascadia earthquake. This bill is like a number of others. I guess I'll start with, we have a little town of Waldport on the coast, and they had a school that was really down in the tsunami zone, and their community got together, and they bought the bond, and they built their school up out of the tsunami zone, which was really and they did it before everybody was giving them breaks to do that. They just felt it was the right thing to do. They also came up with a unique idea for that county that had to do with having caches of supplies and water and blankets and other kinds of stuff put away in different places around their city out of the tsunami zone so that when in the fact something happened, they would evacuate everybody to where they can, and then they would actually have resources there where they evacuated to take care of them. The county picked that up, and they put in a little program in the counties that would give $2,000 to any little municipality or whatever that wants to do a cache. They will 50-50 match. They would give up to $2,000, and they could put their own cache. So in Lincoln County, you have a number of places around the area that are getting better prepared for the eventuality of some kind of big event. But it turns out they're also really available for windstorms and a whole bunch of other things. So you never know what's going to happen. Also coming out of Lincoln County, we have a bill this session that has to do with what they found out in a big storm one time is the road gets blocked on both ends, and all of a sudden you have a parking lot, which used to be a road. And what do we do with those people? There's not any hotel. There's not any whatever. Who takes over? Oh, the rural fire department. And do they have a lot of assets and resources? No. But do they have community members that are willing to take people in their house? And can they figure out a way to deal with that kind of situation? Unexpected deal. So we have a bill that's talking about that and trying to put a work together so we can do it. this is one more in those whole idea of what do we do with respect to seismic retrofitting and others. So, you know, in 19, and the bill goes back to 97 because that's when we started actually putting new building codes in to make buildings survive a little longer. But what it's saying is that we don't have a lot of money at the state. I don't know that you guys know that yet, but there's not a lot of extra money. And in some states, like California, they actually have some money, and they've put it into retrofitting and doing other kinds of stuff. So we always look for the unique way of doing the same thing. So what this bill does is saying cities know valuable assets that they need to protect over time, whether it's historical or whether it's just for life and safety. They recognize that if there's a big earthquake, they may have a problem. And so making sure that some of their buildings, the ones that are the most critical, are retrofitted is really important to them. And one way to do that is to give them the limited authority to spend their future money, i.e. their tax base, for companies, buildings, whatever, that they believe meet that criteria of being essential for life and safety. It may just be that there's enough people in that building at any one time that we want to make sure that that building is structurally sound to get people out. It may mean that we expect that there's going to be a lot of damage and we need to have a place where we can know that it's still going to be standing, we can evacuate people too. There's a whole lot of different reasons why certain buildings are really important for the recovery, the time, the resiliency afterwards, the ability to house people, the ability to have emergency services, the ability to make sure your hospitals can still run. All of those things are essential. What this bill does is say, we don't have a lot of money about this, but we do know which those are, and the people who know them best are the city and counties, and they should be given the opportunity to set standards and to work a way to make sure that those most essential kinds of buildings and places can be retrofitted based on them letting them get a tax break for up to 15 years to pay for those retrofits. It's a simple, from my perspective, solution to a really big problem that we have now that we really truly understand the scope of what could happen with these really large events. And I think it would be a benefit not only to those large events but to smaller ones that happen from time to time and make it possible to recover quicker and meet the needs of the constituents in those areas. So I would love to have your consideration of this bill and hope to see it moving forward. Thank you for your consideration. Any questions, I'd be glad to answer whatever I can. It's a more technical bill than I really know. All the technical people, you have some people coming from Portland and others to talk about it. But thank you for the consideration.
Thank you. Questions for the good senator? Yes, Representative Smith-Warner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Senator. Pleasure to have you here.
It's really nice to see you up there.
We don't spend enough time together.
That's right.
And I apologize for asking you a question that I do not know the answer to already, but we heard in the Rules Committee a bill about the PACE program yesterday, which also one of the ways it can be used is to incentivize through long-term low-interest loans, seismic work, energy stuff. Do you see kind of any relation between these two?
I have to go back and look at PACE, and I really couldn't tell you. I would expect that there are a lot of people trying to figure out what's the best way to move forward and making sure that there are places and things that will be available to people after a big earthquake. And so I wouldn't doubt that it's similar. It probably has different constituents that would like it rather than this one. This one is really about major buildings and facilities places, and I think PACE covers more stuff than that, but I don't know it well enough to answer your question.
Thank you.
Representative Bent, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Does the bill contain any element of how much, how able the owner is to afford these changes herself?
It does not, that I can think of right now offhand. I got to go back and think in my brain. I don't think it does, and we're not. So it's basically they could do nothing and they'd be fine in current statute. This is an incentive to, even if they have some money, to do it. And it's a good question to ask the people who follow me if there's that consideration has been made. But currently it's not, in my opinion, in this bill.
Follow up.
Yeah, please.
Is the concept to prompt an activity that wouldn't otherwise happen?
Yes.
Follow up.
Yes.
And the amount of the taxes on these buildings or the exemption is adequate to do that?
It actually gives them 15 years to get up to the amount of money they put into it. So we hope that it is. I guess this is an attempt to find out, is that the right number? We may have to do something else. Is 15 years long enough, too long? I think those are things that the cities can actually come up with in how they move forward.
Thank you.
And we need to make sure that you have buildings available for all of us that are going to be visiting.
He has plenty of land anyway. are there buildings in your district that would benefit from this provision?
There are some. I think you're going to have to work with the counties to figure out what standard you want to build them. Mm-hmm. We have engineers now that say that they can actually build stuff on the coast to a 9. That's pretty impressive to me. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that is blowout walls and stuff. You saw some of that stuff that happened in Japan and also in Thailand and other places. So it depends on how much you want to put into it. I would say most of our historical buildings in Coos Bay, for example, we're on fill down on the bay. I mean, I don't know what you can do unless you have really long pilings. The one high school building that we built since then, it turns out that the place that was left on the campus up on the hill was a place that had been filled in. So we have 198 poured cast pilings holding that building up. So the people have said when the earthquake happens and the land all goes away, it would be good to have a way to get out of the building, but it's probably still going to be standing, which is a really nice thing to know that there's something on the campus that could possibly survive the big earthquake. But one of my people, administrators at the district office, said, so when does pilings become a wall? Because the one side that was the most exposed, it was every couple feet you had another piling that was being put in. So the structure underneath that building cost as much as the structure above, just to make sure that it was going to do it. So there are ways to do those things. They can be very expensive. And yes, there's a lot of buildings that could take advantage of this in our county. The county commissioners and the cities would have to decide whether that's how they want to spend the limited resources they have. And I think that this bill gives them those options. It doesn't mean that they need to do it.
Great. Thank you. Other questions? Thank you. Very much appreciate your testimony.
Yep.
I'm just going to go down the list. Thomas Dyke, Walt from Multnomah County, Liz Tilbury.
Chair Barnhart and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Thomas Dyke. I'm a retired chemistry professor from the University of Oregon, and I'm testifying today for passage of Senate Bill 311 on behalf of the City Club of Portland and its more than 2,000 members. Early in March, the club members voted to recommend that the legislature should allow cities and counties to grant property tax exemptions to offset seismic retrofitting costs, and Senate Bill 311 is precisely in that vein. I'm a Portland resident now, and I was a member of a research committee of the Portland City Club whose charge was to study earthquake resilience in the Portland metro area and to make practical recommendations as to how that resilience could be improved. During a 9-month period, there are 14 citizens on this committee. We talked with 80 experts in the area of resilience. We talked with building owners. We talked with scientists and other stakeholders concerning these resilience issues. Our report, Big Steps Before the Big One, How the Portland Area Can Bounce Back After a Major Earthquake, and its recommendations were approved by a 98% yes vote by the membership of City Club. And you can find that report at the City Club website. There are 14 recommendations that our committee made. One of them was the one I just mentioned. We asked the legislature to allow cities and counties to grant property tax exemptions to offset retrofitting costs. I think you probably know that the subject of this is that there are many buildings built before the current seismic standards were put into place, which are in danger of severe damage or collapse in the face of a major Cascadia subduction zone earthquake. As an example, in the city of Portland, there are over 1,800 unreinforced masonry structures. This includes 45 school buildings, 35 churches, and 270 multifamily residential structures. And those structures contain about 6,000 residential units, and about a third of those are affordable housing units for low-income families. So our argument, I think, is actually fairly straightforward. We think that life safety considerations, that is, when these buildings, if they collapse, people are in danger of losing their lives. And we think that, and this is well known, that these buildings can collapse in a major earthquake. So we feel that that life safety issue dictates that these buildings should be retrofitted. On the other hand, we heard testimony from building owners about the cost of that retrofitting. And given that Oregon and Portland in particular is facing a housing crisis, particularly in the area of affordable housing, we feel that it's important to develop incentives that can aid the building owners in making these retrofits. We don't want to see those units of residential housing, particularly the affordable housing, withdrawn from the market. So those are our principal arguments. We think that Senate Bill 311 is a good measure to help provide those incentives. And for those reasons, the City Club of Portland supports the passage of this bill. Thanks for listening, and I'll be happy to ask any questions.
Thank you very much.
Hi, I'm Walt McMoney's Chairman Barnhart, Vice Chair Vince and Smith Warner, and members of the committee. My name is Walt McMoney's. I'm here in support of SB 311A, and I guess that's the engrossed bill. My relevant experience is I'm an owner of three unreinforced buildings, two of which are apartment buildings, and another one's a brick garage. I serve on OSPAC, which is the State Seismic Safety Policy Advisory Commission, and I'm also serving on the City of Portland's Policy Committee, which is studying what to do about the URM problem in Portland. Well, the seismic reality is a big earthquake is going to come in the next 50 years. There's about at least a 20% chance, according to Professor Chris Goldfinger, who's the resident expert at OSU and has done enormous research out in the ocean to determine the last incidence of these kinds of earthquake events. Because whenever an earthquake event of this magnitude happens, you have a tsunami, which results in depositing of enormous amounts of sand, and they can go do cores down into the ocean bottom and go back 10,000 years, and they found 40 of these major earthquakes in the last 10,000 years. Anyway, I think the science is not disputed. I support reasonable mandatory seismic upgrading, and that's, I'm an owner, and that's going to hit me. They're going to force me to upgrade my buildings. But the problem is, and I don't call this an incentive program, it's a financing program. There's really no, almost none of the owners can afford the cost of doing this. We're talking somewhere between $50 to $100 a square foot for an apartment building. Well, you can build an apartment building for $130 a square foot. And we're talking about spending half to two-thirds of that just to seismically upgrade the building to depends on the standard you're going to go to. But I think the Portland committee is, city is settling on Bolts, what's called Bolts Plus, which is what San Francisco has, and which Seattle is also considering, which is not as high as life safety, but it's still pretty expensive. This bill would fund an enormous portion, not an enormous portion, a significant portion of the cost, because, for instance, in one of my buildings, my property taxes are $106,000 a year, and that seems like a lot of money. If I didn't have to pay those, my seismic upgrade cost is about $1.5 to $2 million. So saving $106,000 a year for 15 years would put me well on the way to being able to pay for a seismic upgrade. Well, you understand how the mechanism works. It would authorize local jurisdictions to abate property taxes. I know that the city of Portland, for instance, if they were going to go with this, which I hope they are, if it passes, they would obviously impose standards for who gets this and how much you get. So it wouldn't be a ticket for the richest guy in the room to get a large abatement, and the people who are marginal mom-and-pop owners not getting them. Let's see. I think that's about where I am. And just, if anybody's interested in the economics of of his retrofitting. I'm reasonably conversant with that because I have done it on one building.
Thank you very much. Yes, ma'am.
Chair Barnhart and Vice Chairs Vance and Smith Warner and members of the committee. My name is Liz Tilbury. Can you hear me? And I urge your support of SB 311. I'm part of a group called Masonry Building Owners of Oregon, which we formed several years ago. And it was a group that was formed to help guide seismic retrofit policy affecting unreinforced masonry buildings in Portland. We have approximately 30 members in our group, and many of them are small local owners, and we have 100 or maybe close to 125 buildings total at this point. And over the past several years, policy discussions have made two things very clear. First, there are ways to mitigate the risk for URM buildings through retrofitting, and secondly, without a way of financing those or offsetting those costs, they are financially infeasible. Without this bill, thousands of units of rental housing are at risk of being lost, and that really is a very real risk. And also, of course, a concern for so many of our old Portland neighborhoods, which contain unreinforced masonry buildings. We would certainly lose a lot of the city's history in addition to everything else. And the buildings without some kind of help for financing or helping owners to do these upgrades, they'll either be demolished or mothballed. And if they are torn down, they would be replaced. And there are many examples where this has happened, that they're replaced by much more expensive new buildings with rents that are maybe twice what those old buildings were. And this is certainly at a time that we can't afford to be losing affordable housing. In my case, I just wanted to use one of my buildings as an example. Like many owners, this building was expensive to acquire, and I have a large mortgage on it. And there's little equity practically that I could pull out to fund the required retrofits without some help. And at $68 a square foot, which is the estimated cost for this at this point, it would work out to be about $1.3 million for my building, was the estimate. And if this bill were passed, I did the math in terms of the tax savings, and the tax savings would provide somewhere in the range of $350,000 in help, which is, you know, going at least part of the way to enable that. It certainly doesn't come close to offsetting all the costs, but it does begin to give owners a path to financial feasibility to do these upgrades. The risk from a major earthquake is real, as are the cost of doing the upgrades for owners. And I urge your support of this bill, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Questions for this panel? Representative Smith, please.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Do you envision that those condos on the Prom and Seaside would be eligible for this?
I don't know the definition of, I think they're commercial buildings, and I'm not sure those would be deemed to be commercial.
Well, when I read this, it says multifamily as well.
Yeah, that's interesting.
I think a condo would be, I don't know, but I would think a condo would be considered a single family, but.
We do expect to hear from the City of Portland and the Association of Oregon Counties, who may be able to answer some of those more detailed questions on the bill. Yeah. Other questions for this panel? Thank you very much. There is a significant number of documents in OLIS, both from these people and from others who are similarly situated, so I recommend those to the committee. Gail, you have apparently a panel. Is he here? Gil Riddell? You apparently have a panel, do you?
Actually, I'm maybe part of a panel, but City of Portland.
Okay, so let's ask the City of Portland to bring their panel up. I was confused because it's hard to read this. you, Dan. Go ahead.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, for the record, Dan Eisenbeis with the City of Portland. Happy here to speak in support of Senate Bill 311A today. Mr. Chair, I believe I may have been the source for your confusion. Mr. Riddell asked me to sign him up because I was filling out the sheet as he was waiting there. So I wrote down his name for him in the same handwriting.
Gotcha.
This bill, as you've heard and we'll hear more, addresses a very large looming problem in Oregon, and that is that we all know that there is significant risk of a major earthquake that would affect at least much of western Oregon, depending on where it occurs. This bill proposes to add a tool, frankly, where none exists right now in terms of providing an incentive for property owners of multifamily, commercial, and industrial buildings if local taxing jurisdictions agree to establish a program with a property tax benefit to conduct seismic retrofits of those buildings to help protect public health and safety as well as the economy. We believe that this is good policy and that there are a number of provisions built into the bill that we'll speak to that would help it integrate with any future policy steps that the legislature might adopt. Joining me here today are two other staff from the City of Portland. I will let them introduce themselves, but I will turn things over to Jonna Papa Efthimiou. Excuse me.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to address you today. For the record, my name is Jonna Papa Efthimiou, and I work for the City of Portland Bureau of Emergency Management as a planning and policy manager. Let's see if I can. Yeah. So in my role as the planning and policy manager, I think about earthquakes every day. But I think many Oregonians are increasingly aware of that our entire state has earthquake risk, including a 22% chance of a magnitude 9 earthquake in the next 50 years that would be completely devastating to the western half of Oregon and would probably take a generation to rebuild. Many Oregonians may not know that the subduction zone earthquake is not our only earthquake risk. The state also has many areas with active local faults. For example, the most damaging earthquake scenario for Portland would not be Cascadia, but an earthquake in the West Hills Fault, which runs directly underneath the city. Mm-hmm. So it seems that we all have plenty to worry about when it comes to earthquakes. Of course, loss of life is the greatest concern when considering the effects of an earthquake. Earthquakes also cause billions of dollars in property damage. And when buildings are not just damaged, but totally unusable and have to be demolished, residents and businesses are displaced. This tremendously harms economic recovery of a region. And also, the tax assessed value of the improvements literally collapses when the structure collapses. Sadly, widespread building damage is very likely following an earthquake in Oregon, in part because our earthquake risk was not well understood until recently. And as a result, the state building code did not set seismic standards that meet the need until about 1993. So structures built before then are generally quite vulnerable to damage. The older buildings are, the more likely that this is true. So buildings built before 1973 were not bolted to their foundations, according to the state building code. And before 1960, we built brick and concrete block buildings with no rebar inside. The city of Portland has the highest concentration of URMs on the West Coast. So we have more than Seattle, we have more than Vancouver, BC. So we worry a lot about unreinforced masonry buildings, which FEMA also says are the most dangerous building type in an earthquake. However, there are other building types that can also be quite dangerous in an earthquake, including non-ductile concrete buildings and soft story buildings. And depending on when a community developed, this might be for them a more significant risk. This is a picture of the city of Christchurch before and after their 2011 earthquake. They experienced an earthquake quite similar to what we expect could happen in the city of Portland. Christchurch is also similar in size and age of construction to the city of Portland. What Christchurch saw was that 70% of their downtown business district buildings were demolished, either collapsed during the earthquake or had to be demolished afterwards because they were too damaged to repair. As you can imagine, this was devastating for the city. The loss of life and the economic damage that resulted from this will take generation to recover. So this is something we think about a lot.
Until, which one's the before and after?
The left is before, and the right is after.
Okay.
If you look in the center of the right picture, you can see that there's some big open areas that where whole okay. blocks of buildings are just gone. So the good news is that seismic retrofits do work, and these are pictures of two unreinforced masonry buildings in Christchurch that were reinforced and that survived the earthquake and are in use today. Mandatory seismic retrofitting has also saved lives in California, for example, and prevented large economic losses from earthquakes there. However, as building owners have already noted, seismic retrofits are expensive and they're often really hard to finance, even for someone that's relatively well capitalized. The amenity that they provide isn't usually reflected in rents, and the insurance savings are really small. So for small businesses, the cost can be completely prohibited. The City of Portland convened a committee of property owners, developers, and finance professionals over a year ago, and they've been working to finance strategies to retrofit unreinforced masonry buildings. Walt, that spoke before, is a member of that committee, and the tax exemption for the cost of a retrofit was one of the best ideas that they came up with. And now I'll turn it over to Amit to talk about costs and standards.
Chair Bernard and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify mm-hmm. today. My name is Amit Kumar. I'm a senior structural engineer with the City of Portland. The local tax exemption programs authorized under Senate Bill 311 would require property owners to submit seismic retrofit plans that meet national standards. The default standard in the bill is the standard published by the American Society of Civil Engineers, ASCE for short, which is used in evaluating retrofitting existing buildings nationally. More specifically, the standard is ASCE 41-13. The bill specifies that the seismic upgrade should meet or exceed the performance objective defined as the basic performance objective in AAC 41. Simply put, this what we call as the basic performance objective prescribes different standards based on the building's occupancy and the importance of the building. But a vast majority of the buildings would fall under a category where they would be retrofitted to a life safety standard. What life safety standard means is in a design level earthquake, the building may suffer severe damage. It may or may not be repairable, but the building occupants can exit the building safely. In smaller, more frequent earthquakes, the building should be repairable and be able to be occupied in a fairly soon manner. The bill also provides flexibility to local cities and counties to specify alternate retrofit standards for seismic upgrades if local conditions or practical considerations demand it. This type of flexibility allows local jurisdictions to tailor the program to best suit the needs. The plans for seismic upgrades are to be prepared by a registered structural engineer or an architect. Amendment-A3 has clarifying language that the documents prepared by the engineer or architect is subject to the same standard of care that applies to other plans and drawings stamped by an architect or engineer under ORS 671.025 or 672.020. Senate Bill 311 also defines the type of costs that are eligible under this bill. Eligible costs include costs directly related to work necessary for seismic retrofit, the retrofit of the property, necessary costs for demolition and restoration of architectural finishes, electrical, mechanical, and plumbing systems for engineering and design. Ineligible costs include costs associated with refurbishing or remodeling to enhance the aesthetics, functionality, or marketability of the property, cost of abatement of hazardous material, relocation costs, or loss of rent. So with that, I'll turn over to Dan.
Great. Thank you. So I just wanted to show you a couple of examples that we worked through in the city of Portland for some buildings. The first one is the Ace Hotel. It's a historic downtown hotel, prominent, built in 1912. It was never reinforced. And here, a tax credit could be significant in helping finance retrofit costs. If they took the maximum benefit, it would provide up to $30 per square foot for the retrofit. So we could, when we design a local program, choose to permit the owners to use the entire amount or cap the amount per recipient in, as part of the program design. But we estimated the retrofit cost for this building would be up to $70 a square foot. The second example is Lucretia Court. This one's interesting to me because it's obviously an apartment building. There are more than 7,000 residential units in the city of Portland that are in URMs. And so many renters like the folks here would benefit from a retrofit. The tax exemption would, of course, also benefit the owner, although it wouldn't cover the complete cost of retrofitting. In general, we worked through many more examples than I'll show you today, but we found that this type of tax exemption would help an owner finance improvements and benefit the public, but we didn't find a single example where the tax benefit would pay the full cost of a retrofit.
So I would briefly like to call out some of the provisions in the bill regarding accountability as well as the sort of local control and decision points related to this framework. As Amit referenced, the bill ties as a default matter to the national standards for retrofitting from the Association of Civil Engineers, unless a city or county specifies a different local standard to meet local needs. The bill also clearly requires that a project continue to demonstrate regular progress toward completion of the retrofit after it's been approved and to complete the project consistent with the plans that were submitted at the time that the project was approved. If a project fails to do that, then the city or county may cancel the tax exemption and the property owner must essentially repay the amount of the benefit that they've received. There are clawback provisions. There is also a requirement in this bill as part of the application or at any point subsequent during the term of a tax exemption that a property owner report any local, state, or federal incentives that they receive other than this incentive for the seismic retrofitting work that they are doing, and that the amount of that incentive in turn be deducted from the total eligible costs. So this establishes a framework that anticipates potential future incentives that the legislature may choose to consider. As was earlier described by committee staff, this is an option for cities and counties, but it requires agreement from other local taxing jurisdictions representing 75% of the property tax base. And those local programs can be tailored in scope to the most vulnerable or dangerous buildings. Similarly, those local programs can have a cap on the total amount of credits or exemptions that are granted or the total number of approvals at the local level. And we anticipate that given the high threshold for establishing a program that there would be robust conversations about the scale and scope of those programs. The City of Portland is very much interested in this and appreciates your consideration, urges your support. I also just want to note our appreciation for Senator Roblin as well as Representative Boone and Representative McEwen, who are all sponsoring this bill. We appreciate that there are other parts of the state where this may be a useful tool. And to Representative Smith's question regarding Seaside, hypothetically, yes, the city or county there could establish a program where those buildings would be eligible, but it would require establishment of a local program. Got it. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Marsh, please.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for the information. As someone who lives in a 1902 brick house, this is a really important subject. Does a retrofit increase property tax base for a project?
Do you want to take? So right now, part of what we're struggling with in the financing is when you retrofit a building, your rent generally doesn't go up. It's not capitalized in other ways. So it makes sense that that the property taxes would not go up in the long term. I think we would,
we hope that the market will increasingly value seismic safety as a characteristic of buildings, and people will want that. So in the very long term, I think there's a possibility that that could happen.
Yes, please.
But then are we creating, I mean, if the, and perhaps if Doug's going, I don't know if he's going to testify for the assessors, but are we creating any kind of a conflict here with a project? Would that building be reassessed on the tax rolls without an ability to recapture?
I think you're talking past each other. You might talk a little bit about how buildings get valued for the property tax purposes. I think that's where you were going with your answer last time.
Do you want to jump in?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Marsh, if I may. Mm-hmm. I think we would defer to the assessors on this. If I'm not sure if they plan to testify today. Certainly, if there was an increase in assessed value, that would apply after the term of the exemption ends. But the exemption that's authorized in the bill is specific to the taxes associated with the value of the existing building.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I understand the theory, that is, we as a broad community decide we're going to invest all of our money in repairing a situation that otherwise could cost us a great deal more if we aren't prepared for the seismic event. But there is no doubt that we are all making an investment statewide given how our school fund works. So do you think those who might choose to take advantage of this would object to having a sign in the yard that calls all of that out? Says property owner's name and the numbers and where the money's going. I say this because we're going to discuss a bill here in a few minutes that does exactly that for centrally assessed properties. The underlying theme being that we want to let people know how their money's being spent or revenue is being lost. So what do you think?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Bentz, certainly as the bill is currently structured, given that a city or county would need to adopt an ordinance to implement a program, and there would need to be agreement from other local jurisdictions that conversation would be subject to a public process and public hearings. The bill right now has opportunities for folks to understand the potential impact in the community. I'm not sure that we necessarily know the answer to your hypothetical about whether individual building owners would object to some sort of notice posted at the site of the building.
Oh, I can guess.
Thank you. Other questions? What other sources of funds are there for this sort of retrofitting other than the financing available to the owners themselves? Grant money, other tax considerations, other kinds of things that might help to fund this kind of a project?
There is a federal historic tax credit. Since URMs haven't been built since 1960, most URMs are potentially historic, and so they could utilize that program. In the city of Portland, we have a lot of URMs in the Old Town Chinatown neighborhood, and we've set aside $5 million of urban renewal funds to try and spark some development there. But candidly, there is the seismic CPACE legislation that passed that provides an opportunity to take out a long-term loan that functions sort of as a lien against the property. That doesn't actually give you money to do the work. It just it's a mechanism for financing, but the owner still has to come up with the money. So we've struggled candidly to find other ways to finance the work. We've been really working on this for the last 2 years.
Okay. Other questions for this panel? Thank you very much. I have one more. There's been an amendment proposed.
Thank you for
that.
The
we
reminder.
Haven't talked about yet. Do you want to make any comments about
sure.
that amendment?
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, Amit referenced this very briefly in his remarks. So there is a -A3 amendment on OLIS this amendment would address essentially technical concerns that were raised by the engineers about some of the specific wording or phrasing that is in the A engrossed version of the bill. The amendment seeks to clarify that the manner in which architects or engineers prepare and stamp plans for seismic retrofit is in the same manner as for which they prepare and stamp plans for other purposes, with a standard of care that's no more or no less than their usual manner.
Okay. Others have claimed that this amendment may actually reduce some of the provisions of the, some of the sideboard provisions, make them less specific and therefore less useful. Do you have any comment on that criticism?
So the part of the amendment changes the wording that currently references performance standard known as the basic performance objective for existing buildings. The concern that was raised around that is that the term performance standard in lowercase may be interpreted to imply a warranty or guarantee about the performance of the building over time, which is something beyond the sort of standard of care that would usually apply. So that the amendment would change that term from performance standard to standard. In so doing, it references directly to the basic performance objective for existing buildings, whereas the amendment referenced that performance standard or higher within the ASCE 41 standards, but the only amendment to the clause allowing a city or county to adopt or specify a different standard to meet local needs is the deletion of that term performance. Certainly the intent of the city of Portland looking at standards that would might deviate for unreinforced masonry buildings is to identify a standard that produces a meaningful retrofit that's cost effective and that's at a performance level that's similar to what would be achieved through the ASCE 41 standards. So that is our intent with that. It also provides flexibility for a city or a county to track with any future updates to the ASCE standards if there were updates in future years, because due to legislative drafting, the bill currently ties to the published version as of the end of 2016.
I've reviewed the fiscal and revenue impact statements. They're pretty vague because the statute, of course, would not establish any of these projects. It would simply allow the local communities to do that. What are your estimates for the property tax loss based on the kinds of the level and amount of projects that might be authorized in the city of Portland using this mechanism?
So I would invite Jonna to offer any comments, but Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, I'm not sure that we've gotten to that level of detail.
It is many millions of dollars, isn't it?
Possibly, yes. What I can tell you is that Portland's experience with other tax exemption programs, for instance, with housing, those programs all include a locally established cap either on the number of new approvals each year or on the total amount of the exemptions that's being granted in order to provide revenue certainty and make sure that the scale of the program fits within essentially what local taxing jurisdictions can afford. And we anticipate that there would be a robust discussion about the scale of a program in order to achieve agreement with other taxing jurisdictions.
So you would like us to allow the city and the local jurisdictions to establish the cap for your area? Is that what I'm hearing?
That is correct.
Okay. Let me get back to for a second to Representative Bence's implied question. You may have intended this, maybe not. I'm not sure. But, of course, your way the mechanism works for funding schools in the state is if the local school funding declines, the funds come out of the state school fund across the whole state. So what that means, of course, is that taxpayers in other places will be helping to pay for the schools, a greater portion of the schools in the places where the projects actually exist. And, of course, the schools don't have any particular incentive to object to this kind of a program because they would mostly be made whole just under the normal mechanism. Have you thought about addressing that issue in this proposal at all? That effectively what you're asking for is a is an uncapped property tax exemption, 40% of which, rough numbers, would be paid for by the rest of the taxpayers across the state, unless I misunderstand somehow.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, believe that that is partially addressed through the high threshold for agreement from local taxing jurisdictions. So the 75% threshold in Portland, for instance, would essentially require that there be sign-off from at least the city and the county and the school districts. And that threshold was established in the Brownfield tax incentive authorization that was approved by the legislature in 2016. Excuse me. So that would demand that there be consideration from local taxing jurisdictions that have direct skin in the game in terms of foregone revenue.
Great. Thank you. Other questions? Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. Gil Riddell, Marshall Koba, please. Please. Yes, we definitely want to hear from Mr. Schmidt. Representative Marsh gave me the idea.
I'll begin, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Gil Riddell, Association of Warren Counties. You have my comments before you and Olis, so I'll simply say good bill should pass.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, I was not going to testify on this bill today, but there was a question raised by Representative Marsh, I believe, about the value of the property and assessed value.
Just wondered.
To be honest, this could increase the value of the property. Anytime there are upgrades done to a property, whether it generates extra rent or we see an increase in sales prices because of that, we reflect that in the value of the property, which could then also affect the assessed value of the property. So there's multiple ways at the end of this exemption period in 15 years that the value of that property could be higher than just what the normal trending would have been because of the improvements to the property. Does that? Okay.
Koba.
Good afternoon, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. My name is Marshall Koba, here today representing the American Council of Engineering Companies, 110 member firms across the state, about 3,000 engineers. We are here in support of Senate Bill 311 with the -3 amendments. Following the passage from the Senate, our legal counsel saw some concerns with the amended version. I want to thank Senator Roblin's staff, who worked closely with Rosie, Dan Eisenbeis with the City of Portland, and Cindy Robert with the American Institute of Architects, who also are in support, the architects who are in support of the -3 amendments. Our concerns were that the engineers and architects would need to broadly certify the performance of the seismic improvements, which is an unqualified certification, it's a certification and a representation of future performance, which are both beyond the legal obligation required by the law and our professional liability insurance. We think the -3s avoid potential misunderstanding from the agencies and from potential clients on our role. We think the -3s will fix this concern and allow engineers and architects to add our stamp, which is envisioned in the bill, and we support Senate Bill 311 with the -3 amendments. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? Representative Marsh?
Thank you, Chair.
Yeah.
Mr. Riddell, a question for you. I'm thinking about some of the very small cities in my part of the world that could really potentially benefit from something like this, and the complexity of the program in terms of a city's ability to have the personnel to make evaluations of the material that's submitted. I just wondered if you've thought about whether or not some you might be able to somehow offer some centralized support so that small entities would have that expertise in a centralized way.
Mr. Chair, Representative Marsh, that's something that jurisdictions should explore, certainly. we'll have some counties likely who won't have the wherewithal to do this mm-hmm. right away. So I think if cities are in the same boat, they should be talking. They have to talk anyway because they've got to reach a 75% agreement on the rate of taxation to even do it. So I think the idea is a good one.
Thank you. Anything else? Thank you, gentlemen, very much. We appreciate your testimony. With that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill or Senate Bill 311. Representative Lively is here. We'll open the work session on House Bill 2407. You want to tell us about that one?
Sure, Mr. Chair. So House Bill 2407 is a measure this committee has heard a bit about. We do have one amendment up already, but it was relating to I'm starting on the wrong bill. You said 2407, Mr. Chair.
I did, yes. And that is the bill you're here for.
2407.
Yes. Right. I was thinking of the following bill. 2407 with the -2 amendment is relating to making changes to the deferred billing credits program. So as a brief reminder of what the deferred billing credit program is, and I'll describe the changes to it. Deferred billing credits is a program that allows county assessors, in instances where there is a property tax liability or property tax assessment that's in dispute, so it's going to the court, it's being litigated, the assessor can, rather than receiving those funds and now being distributed to the districts with the potential for a large refund coming out once the litigation has been resolved, the assessor can issue a deferred billing credit where the property tax owner of the property, or the lessee, I suppose, is not required to make that payment, but the assessor records it as if that payment was made. So the property, the taxpayer retains the funds, and then once the court case is resolved, then depending upon the outcome of the court case, those funds are either have to be paid, or if it's the court rules in favor of the taxpayer, then there would be no requirement to make that payment. And that's a pretty simplified version. Of course, it'll depend upon the outcome of the court case. The change to 2407 with the -2 amendment is it's replacing the deferred billing credit statutory language. It leaves deferred billing credits that are outstanding now today or unchanged, but it replaces that deferred billing credit program, if you will, with a potential refund credit. So the difference with the potential refund credit is it's in the same scenario as the deferred billing credit, so nothing changes there. You're talking about a property tax assessment dispute. But instead of no payment being made by the taxpayer would be required to make a payment of that disputed amount. That payment amount then is deposited by the county treasurer into an account, an interest-bearing account. There's recommendations of putting out with the treasury, but there are not specific requirements on where it would go. But it's an interest-bearing account, and then upon resolution of the case, those funds would either be used to pay the tax liability that is then due or would be used to refund back to the taxpayer. And the difference there between the two is not just the exchange of funds, but also that interest that can accrue. And there's some, if you want to go into the detail of the paperwork now, I can talk about the revenue impact, or I can just stop there with the overview of the program differences.
Well, why don't we let those occupying the witness table to tell us why they want this and whatever else they have to say about it.
Thank you.
Representative?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is John Lively. I represent House District 12, the City of Springfield. So I think if you remember when we started this journey on this particular bill, what we were trying to get at was large sums of money by large corporations that were being held in dispute over taxes owed. And the way the process worked in the past, they held those funds and could hold them for a long time based on the courts and how long all of this took to resolve it. And so part of our goal when we started was to try to penalize, and I use that term loosely, but penalize from a standpoint at the end, collect some interest in that and all of that money that was set there, the argument being that they had use of that money during all of that time and collected it. So that was the simple where we started, and we thought we could do that. But then assessors and others explained to us what the bill, what the original bill was about, the deferred billing and how it worked. And so I was glad to work with the assessors in that to try to find a way to still deal with the issue, and it's part of it's a perception issue by the public when they see these things going on about what's really happened. And the second one is just is a financial issue. Find a way, another way, to deal with this issue in these cases where there's a dispute over a large amount of taxes and who holds the money. So essentially what this does is changes who holds the money in these disputes from the person, the company, to the county and the assessors and the treasurers in this particular case. And so in the case where there's a dispute, the money, they have to pay their taxes. They would get a discount on their taxes like anybody else did if they paid their taxes on time. But they would pay required to pay the taxes instead of them holding the disputed amount. The county and or the treasurer would hold the disputed amount. Otherwise, nothing else changes from the standpoint of the process that the assessors have to go through to reach resolution in that. But from my perspective, it does accomplish one of the things we were trying to accomplish was if in these cases where there's a substantial amount of funds that are in dispute, that the funds be held, that the taxes be paid and the funds be held by the counties and the tax assessors rather than the companies until the dispute is resolved. And Doug is here, can talk specifically about the amendment and how it works. And again, I just want to express my appreciation for working. I've learned more about this than I ever thought I should know, frankly, about this. But I appreciate it because I do think this is a good step forward, and I appreciate the efforts. So, Doug.
When you write bills that touch the Revenue Committee, the outcome you've just described is quite normal.
Normal. Okay, I feel better.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, Douglas Schmidt, Polk County Assessor, testifying on behalf of Oregon State Association of County Assessors and on the Dash 2 amendment. I did a comparison sheet that I submitted for testimony, and so when that comes up, it'll hopefully try and explain some of the differences. And again, a little bit of history. We originally came into this bill opposing it because we felt that the bill was doing what it was supposed to do, or the law, and that was protecting taxing districts from large single-year refunds in high-value appeals. And the poster child for this is Comcast that's been going on for years. So most of what we're doing with this statute is on Comcast, the counties that are deferring. There are some counties that are deferring some other communications companies because they have a higher value in their county for those companies. There were some amendments to the original bill to charge interest on the refund on any additional taxes that would be paid. And then the amendment was changed to create a variable interest rate based on the state income tax laws. And at that point, we felt that it was starting to get complicated on how that would be calculated. So I made a suggestion to the committee that we look at just having the taxpayer pay all of the taxes, and then we hold that disputed tax in abeyance in an account that is monitored and administered by the county treasurer. So that's where we are today. And based on the comparison that I did, This is solely at the discretion of the assessor, the same as the original bill, ORS 305-286. It's up to the assessor to determine if there is a risk involved to the districts based on the value of the appeal and the expected length of the appeal. If they believe that there's risk to the districts, they can implement this bill, this law, to set aside some of those disputed taxes. So the first step on both of them would have been there's an appeal filed to tax court. The assessor determines that there is a significant risk to the districts down the road. The assessor under the old bill would calculate the amount of the deferred taxes based on the value that was in dispute. That amount was held out of the tax bill, so they paid a lower amount of tax. Under this bill, they would pay the full amount of the tax. We'd still have to do the same calculations to determine the amount of tax that could be at impact. And that amount of the tax, when it's paid by the taxpayer, would be placed into an account administered by the county treasurer. So basically, that money would not go into the normal distribution percentage at that time to all the taxing districts. Once the the only interest that would be accruing is whatever is earned off of that account. There is a fund that the treasurers can use that's, I believe, administered through the treasurer. It's a very minimal interest, 1% maybe a year. So we're not talking about huge amounts of interest, but there is some return on that, either to the taxing districts or to the taxpayer. So as the appeal goes through, each year when the money comes in, the assessor has to identify to the taxpayer and to the treasurer how much of that money is to be set aside out of that taxpayer's tax payment. And once they pay that, then it's set aside. Once the appeal is finaled and the order is given, if there is a refund to the taxpayer, then the treasurer would distribute that money out of the account, the credit account, to the taxpayer. If the Department of Revenue, say in a Comcast case, would win, then that money would be distributed out to the taxing districts using the normal distribution percentages as of the year, each year that that property had been placed in that fund, just like any other distribution we would do on, say, omitted property or anything like that. There's standard language that we've put into this bill on the distribution. It gets the same impact. If there's issues where we have to recalculate, there's compression that's involved in that too, just like any other normal refund or additional tax that we have to account for. So it's very similar, but it's totally different. We do almost the exact same thing through each of these bills, the law and the bill, except under HB 2407-2, we would collect the money and put it aside. And then it's either refunded at the end, where under the deferred credit billing, it would have to be an additional tax payment from the taxpayer, or the money's distributed out to the taxing districts if the case is won by the state or by the county. This can be used by a county under certain conditions, over $1 million on high value county appraised property. So it isn't just a centrally assessed, just Department of Revenue issue. So if you have any questions, I'd be happy to try and answer them for you.
You cover this very thoroughly, but you left out one key point, actually two key points. And let me start with the more important one first. There are three. I'm just going to give you the list. The first one is the county treasurer qualified and capable of managing the short-term investment of this kind? And do we have sideboards either in this bill or somewhere else that will dictate the way in which that's done and the risks that are taken? That's question number one.
Okay.
Question number two, what happens to the interest that's earned on the account, if any?
Mm-hmm.
And the third question is, what about the 3% discount for early payment?
Chair Barnhart, I'm going to let Diane Belt, who represents the tax collectors, address these.
Thank you.
You bet.
I knew there'd be a way of getting you in.
You bet. Chair Barnhart, committee members, my name is Diane Belt, and I represent the Oregon Association of County Tax Collectors. The treasurer question, the treasurer manages all kinds of different funds because sometimes if there is a dispute, the law states that the disputed amount is held by the county treasurer and distributed at some point in time. So it isn't anything that isn't new to the treasurer. They do that with our bankruptcy account. We actually turn some of our funds, instead of turning it over to the districts, it's managed by the treasurer, and then we use that to pay for attorney fees for bankruptcies. So it isn't anything different, and the treasurers have no problem with this, and most counties have an investment portfolio, and they have ways of investing their funds. So our communication with the treasurers, no, this is not going to be an issue. The second question, any interest that is earned on the account by the treasurers is distributed with the refund.
if it goes back to the county or to the districts, they get the interest earned, or the taxpayer gets the interest that's earned. So they monitor that and they take care of that. Discount, when they pay their taxes and we go through and look at the deferred billing accounts to determine if they've paid, then the discounted amount will go in to, because they did pay and they did receive a discount, so they will get that advantage and that money will go in there. I'd just like to add to this, the way that we're currently doing this administratively is extremely difficult for the tax collectors, because once the roll is certified, it becomes our tax roll. So we have to make all these corrections, so we have to manipulate these accounts and monitor them and try to watch them. This just puts it back into the good old changes to the roll. You know, the process happens. At the end, we say, great, we've got deferred billing credit, treasurer, when we do our turnover, please put this amount in the deferred billing credit potential account. I'm too old for that. Potential refund credit into that account, and we're done. The tax collectors are very pleased over this change. It makes our job so much easier, better tracking and accountability. So we're very pleased with the change. Does that answer all your questions?
I think it does. Well, there's one other that it generates, though. I think it would be useful for us to have some information on how the treasurers are doing with their investments. And I know that that's probably not something you can do off the cuff, so it might be useful to get that. I'm sure that's a public record. That's just something that we don't happen to know.
No, yeah, Chair Barnhart, committee members, I used to work for a treasurer for a few years. There's the investment pool that a lot of the counties can put money into, but I believe there's a limit. So most counties that I know of, their treasurer, and you'd probably have to talk to the Treasurer's Association, they actually have an investment policy that they go by as to how they invest their monies. Like, I'm sure Washington County investment policy is way different than Polk County's.
Right.
But that would be something that you probably would want to talk with, or we could find out from the treasurers, but I would assume, yes, Kyle can do that. I see his smiling face. He's so happy. And that's going to be a county by county process, but typically they will have some kind of an investment policy as to where the money is put.
Thank you very much. Other questions for this panel? Thank you. We really appreciate your testimony. I think what I'm going to do, especially given the fact that we've lost a bunch of people to the transportation work, is set this over so people can mull it a bit, and then consider the amendments in the bill. Hopefully in the next couple of days. So I'm going to close the work session now, and hold it over for tomorrow, and let's see where we go. 2088 is ready, is it?
Dash seven.
I'm really hesitant to try to go ahead with so many members missing. We only have a bare quorum at this point. I think maybe what we ought to do is open the public hearings on the Senate bills and get those public hearings out of the way, and then try to hold these work sessions over until tomorrow. So why don't we go ahead with the public hearing on Senate Bill 29. Chris, do you want to open that? Chris, do you want to give us the... Jeff, why don't you come up?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Senate Bill 29 comes from the Department of Revenue, and it updates Oregon's connection date to federal law regarding the tax treatment of debt forgiveness. And normally this kind of bill would be in the reconnect bill, but I think at the time the bills were drafted, because this one doesn't apply particularly to taxable income, it was drafted in a separate bill. The issue has come up that in the future this may actually appear in the reconnect bill, but it's a standalone bill this session.
Okay. Mr. Anderson.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this is a Department of Revenue concept. As Chris described, it is really just a cleanup bill. The statute that is being amended, 314.306, really just provides guidance to taxpayers in the department about what laws control when it comes to discharge of indebtedness for bankruptcy, and it's federal law. So just a cleanup bill that updates the the connection date.
Okay. And what's the, what is the subject of this, of this bill?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, what this will do is, again, this bill speaks to the tax treatment of items that have been discharged, items of indebtedness that have been discharged into bankruptcy, and it just clarifies that federal law controls those tax treatments. And so the issue with this was there was an outdated reference in here to 1995. The federal law was updated in 2005, and so what this will do is just clarify the guidance that for those discharge of indebtedness and bankruptcies that commenced on or after the effective date of this federal change, it'll clarify what law controls.
Okay.
And that federal law would control whether, regardless of whether we updated this statute, but it cleans up the guidance.
I see. We're stuck with it whether we do this or not.
Correct, Mr. Chair.
All right. Any questions? Any other questions for Mr. Henderson? Any reason we shouldn't work the bill today? We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 29 and open a work session on Senate Bill 29. Representative Smith Warner.
Mr. Chair, I move that we move Senate Bill 29 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Smith Warner moves Senate Bill 29 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection to the bill? Hearing none, it's so ordered. Who'd like to carry this bill?
Me.
Oh, Representative Smith Warner will carry. We'll close the work session on Senate Bill 29, open a public hearing on Senate Bill 30. Chris,
sure.
Is that yours?
Yes.
Please.
This bill would allow the Department of Revenue to consider the role of foreign affiliates when making a decision as to whether or not a collection of corporations are a unitary group. So just for background, you have the starting point is a federal consolidated return, so you can have a group of taxpayers that are all on that consolidated return. They work closely together. For when they file the Oregon return, to the extent that a group of corporations are a unitary group, they effectively operate as a single business. They're all included on that same return. And as you may recall, the state operates on a water's edge principle. Basically, the Department of Revenue can't look to foreign companies. We can't include their income to tax. There are situations, though, where in making a unitary determination, so for example, if the Department of Revenue is looking at Corporation A and Corporation B to decide whether or not they should file separate returns or be included on a single return because they're a unitary corporation, if looking at Corporation C, which is a foreign company, if looking at that company allows the department to determine that A and B are a unitary group, this is what that bill would allow. Under current law, the Department of Revenue may know about Corporation C, the foreign affiliate, but they have to ignore that information, and then Corporation A and B would file separate returns. This basically changes the law to allow the Department of Revenue to consider that foreign affiliate, not to bring in any of that income or any of that information or any of the sales or anything, just for the determination that A and B are in fact a unitary group and should be included on the same tax return.
Okay. Why don't you say why you want this?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
For the record.
Thank you. Jeff Henderson with the Department of Revenue. This bill comes to you at the request of the governor on behalf of the department. It passed the Senate unanimously. Chris did a nice job of setting this up. Unitary determinations, why that's important for corporate tax. The entire income of a unitary group is to be apportioned amongst the states, and so we Oregon ties to federal taxable income as a starting point. It gets us that water's edge. And the income in that federal taxable income may include multiple unitary groups. So when the Oregon return is filed, it's that federal starting point, federal taxable income. income of the unitary group stays in, and any income of a non-unitary member is removed from the tax return. So that's it's important. It's those are it would be subtracted out of the income, and so those are sizable subtractions. It's a very common audit issue. It gets reviewed, and so currently, the provision in statute, as Chris described, prohibits the department from looking at transactions, relationships that occur with an affiliate that's located outside of the United States. And again, the intent of looking at that relationship would just be to determine if those U.S. corporations that file as part of the same consolidated federal return are in a unitary relationship. It does not attempt to bring in the income of the foreign affiliate into the Water's Edge base. It doesn't bring in the factors. It's just for purposes of looking at the relationships with that foreign affiliate. Because what will happen is it may be due to a corporate inversion to where a corporation now locates outside of the U.S. into a foreign country, or there's an acquisition, and so you have a member now that's in a foreign country. That affiliate in the foreign country might be financing the U.S. corporations, and so when you look at the two U.S. corporations directly, you don't see a relationship between the two. But when you look at their relationship to this foreign corporation, you can see that there's loans or there's financing, there's maybe common ownership. And so it creates that unitary relationship. You can make that unitary determination based on the relationship with the foreign country. This is consistent with other states' treatment. Our neighbors, California, Idaho, they are worldwide combined states, but they have a Water's Edge election. And so if taxpayers that elect a Water's Edge filing in California or Idaho, it's clear. They say you make your unitary determinations first, and then you will apply the Water's Edge restrictions, which would be just which income is included in the return. But you determine your unitary relationships first.
Okay. Thank you. Questions? Yes, Representative Buehler.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Barnhart. I'm still having a hard time understanding the why of this. Why do we need it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Buehler, this is not a very common issue, but we do come across this in audit, and so the information is there. We can see this information, Representative, but we are not we're not able to make a unitary determination because we're not able to look at the relationships or transactions with an affiliate that's located in a foreign country. And so even though by looking at that information, we can see that there is a unitary relationship between these U.S. corporations that are part of this federal consolidated return, but we can't make that determination. And so the income is then just considered non-business and removed from the return. So it's pulled out of the income that would be subject to apportionment to Oregon. This bill will just allow, kind of take the blinders off and just allow for a clear unitary picture.
Let me see if I can say it a different way and see if, because it'll help me understand if I understand it or not, and then you can also say whether I've got it. I think what you've just said is that under the current law, you can't consider who the foreign owner might actually be or the foreign affiliates of several different businesses in Oregon when you're considering whether or not they should be filing a unitary return. Under this bill, if it's passed, you will be able to simply look at the actual structures that exist anywhere in the world and make a determination as to whether these local businesses are related to each other through that process, through looking at their external relationships with other places, and use that information to determine whether the local, whether people who are subject to the local tax have to file a unitary return.
Mr. Chair, that's exactly right.
Is that a okay?
That is exactly right, and it's not looking to bring in the income of that foreign affiliate
right
into the Oregon return or its factors into the Oregon return. It's just looking at the relationships, the business transactions, relationships that foreign corporation has with the U.S. corporations that we are making a unitary determination for.
Now, we've got a revenue estimate of essentially nothing, I think. Why is that? Wouldn't this either make or reduce income for the state?
Mr. Chair, it potentially has that impact on either side, but you're talking about, if we're talking about corporation A and corporation B, it's whether or not they're both on the same return or separate returns. Because we're talking about corporations that have, that would be taxable in Oregon.
Okay.
And if A and B are connected through this foreign affiliate, then they would be, then that's the determination that A and B are in fact a unitary group and should be included on the same return.
Okay.
And if they can't look at that, then they, if the foreign affiliate has to be disregarded, if you will, then corporation A and corporation B would file separate returns.
Okay, but depending upon whether it's the size of the profit estimate or the income estimate was related somehow to tax rates, that one of those methods would increase the revenue, wouldn't it?
Correct. Well, that's why there's a minimal impact instead of the
No impact. All right. Okay. It also, I think, may mean that the green eyeshade people in London who are filling out the tax returns only have to do one instead of two if this bill passes for Oregon.
Potentially.
For Oregon. I mean, that's, if I understand the bill correctly, that would be the effect of it, wouldn't it?
That's my understanding.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it's unknown whether where the tax returns are being prepared.
Well, no, of course
so,
not. Yeah.
And maybe it's just an affiliate in the foreign country, but not a parent. Maybe the parent company is still in the U.S., so where they prepare their U.S. tax returns.
Well, of course, that's irrelevant. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
And just to clarify, so you have these members of the unitary group that are part of the federal consolidated return, and they're included in the Oregon return. The unitary business principle pulls in the entire income. It just states that the entire income of the unitary group is subject, maybe apportioned by states. And so that'll include affiliates that aren't doing business in Oregon. So the situation will be like if it's determined they're not to be unitary, that income will be pulled out of the return, and they may not have an Oregon filing requirement. Under the unitary business principle, that income would remain in the base to be apportioned amongst the states in which the unitary group conducts business. So
that's another issue. Thank you. Anything else for Mr. Henderson on this one? All right. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 30. Colleagues, I think I'd like to hold this one over till tomorrow for the work, just so we have another day to think on it. The two House bills that are up, Paul, one of them is ready. The other one isn't, if I have that right. Is there any reason why we shouldn't hold those over till tomorrow? All right, so we'll hold over the House Bills 2774 and House Bill 2088 till tomorrow. And then we'll open the public hearing on Senate Bill 32. Who's on that one? Is that yours, Chris?
It is not, but I will pinch hit.
Okay.
This one provides for the imposition of either a penalty or failure to pay estate tax when due, or penalty for initial failure to file an estate tax return when due. And I'm pretty sure Jeff can explain it much better than I can.
Please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jeff Henderson with the Department of Revenue. Senate Bill 32 would align the penalty provisions for failure to pay and failure to file. It would align those penalties for the estate tax program with other tax programs that the department administers, personal income tax, corporate income tax, other small programs. The department has looked at this statute as requiring one or the other consistently with the other tax programs, but it was brought to our attention that the statute as drafted does allow for both a penalty to a 5% penalty to file late and a 5% penalty to pay late, which is unusual from other programs. It's usually one or the other. So what this would do would clarify statute that it is going to be one or the other that applies, not both, and it would make it consistent with other tax programs. The department can administer it the way it is. We can continue to administer it with two separate 5% penalties, but it is inconsistent with other tax programs.
Okay. Is there a revenue estimate?
I believe it's in OLIS, and it is a We have a the revenue impact is minimal, and the fiscal impact is a no expenditure impact.
All right. Any questions? And he's the only witness on this bill, is he?
Correct.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 32. Colleagues, I think I'm going to hold this one over till tomorrow as well for work. Let's just go through what we've done here. We held the public hearing on House Bill 311. We opened and closed the work session on 2407, and we've held it over till tomorrow. We've held over 2774 and 2088 till tomorrow. We passed out Senate Bill 29, and Representative Smith Warner will carry. And we've held over the work sessions on Senate Bill 30 and Senate Bill 32. Have I got that?
Mr. Chair, you have to hold over the hearing and the work session.
I have to do both. Okay. Well, then we'll do that. We'll hold over. We'll reopen the hearing tomorrow in case anybody else wants to talk. That seems really unlikely. But the intention would be to work them tomorrow unless somebody has a problem. All right. Anything? Do I need to make any other announcements? I do not. Thank you. With that, remember, committee, we meet in the morning, 8:30.
Oh, that's right.
We will hear briefly from the state treasurer, also from Paul on OTIM with the joint committee here in this room at 8:30, and then we meet again at 1 o'clock. With that, committee is adjourned.
Thank you.